Faith Uncut, a podcast that explores faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira. And today we will be discussing faith that affirms blackness.
All right. Faith that affirms blackness.
Yes, I think this is just a natural progression of some of the subjects and topics that we've been covering. But we're going to dive into this because, one, it's worthy. Two, we need to understand that obviously there are some things that happen within faith spaces that do not affirm blackness or, you know, just other characteristics that people might have. And we want to understand why that's occurring. And when it is identified, how we can counteract that energy within the faith space. You do it for yourself personally, and then there are ways that you can influence how your faith space begins to affirm you as who you are, as how you're presenting.
So welcome to all the non-black people.
Hey, y'all.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you for
coming. We appreciate you.
Please don't bail out. This should be something here.
I just feel like y'all could learn something here, okay? And we appreciate your feedback. But again, and this is not meant to be dismissive, it's not about you today. It's not about that particular perspective. And it's important to deep dive because we've talked about these microcultures within our American Christian culture. And when you go into certain spaces, you will find that first and foremost, your membership in the African American community or Hispanic American community or whatever your hyphen community is the first thing that is affirmed. It is centered in your faith space. Likewise, there are some times where you go into spaces under the general umbrella of Christianity and you don't see yourself. Mm-hmm. So because that is very real and produces a very real set of emotions and feelings and actions for certain people, we're just going to kind of look at what that looks like.
Something's in my head, and it's a Ooh. Quote. It's not an African proverb.
Okay.
If you don't have black friends that don't talk about white people around you, you don't have any black friends. That is the quote.
That was in your head.
Yeah. And that's true.
Okay.
Because, you know, this is something that's, I mean, it's not necessarily negative all the time, but it's something that's very real for us at all times. And so if you never hear about it, then you're missing out on some of the humanity of that person.
That's true.
Welcome aboard.
Yes, we really do appreciate you being here.
We're just talking about us. We're not talking against anyone, but we're just talking about us.
So. We are talking because
we need to talk.
Us.
We need to talk to the people because it's been a lot of overlooking. So here we go.
Yeah.
All right.
First things first. Okay, so we're talking about faith that has affirmed blackness. I guess we should start with faith that has not affirmed blackness. Mm-hmm.
That's the reason why we're having the conversation.
So yes.
There are elements of particularly the Christian faith, American Christian faith, that has not done this. No. And some do it very well.
Yes.
Okay. So you have the AME Church. Great job.
Yes.
You have SDAs actually do a great job.
Okay.
You know.
That's all you got.
That's off the top of my head. That's.
That's what about the Kojiks?
The Kojiks are free with their blackness.
Okay.
And there is some affirmation there in terms of being able to fully express those things. I don't know that I would say that there's a deliberate affirmation. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's where my hesitancy is. Like I wouldn't expect to go into a church and hear a message about liberation or anything like that. Why that's even important. Because
right.
Because a lot of our black churches still adopt heavily from white evangelical
right.
churches.
Mainstream.
Black evangelical churches are. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's not a knock against them. It's just because the body of evidence has been controlled, or the body of information has been controlled so tightly for so long that when we start to draw from resources, either you're not exposed to all of this scholarship mm-hmm. By black people, or you just like, you're getting the Paula White book, or you're getting the, you know, you're getting all of these things, you know, the Joyce Meyer, the Joel Osteen book, you know, you're getting all of these things that, you know, that's not their, that's not what they do.
Right. That's not their wheelhouse. They don't necessarily take those materials and the space within those materials.
And even on the academic side, you may say, all right, I'm a, like we mentioned in the previous episode, John MacArthur or whatever, like you may have been, you know, in a John Piper mold, or, you know, Tim Keller or something, like you, there's always been, I don't know what to call it. Black people look at white people and say, I want that. And so when, not that that's the right thing to do, but it's a reasonable thing to do if you've been oppressed by, you know, you want some more than what you have. So when Christian schools, like the, in Bob Jones University, when they have deliberately tried to segregate and cut out blacks from attending these schools, I want some education. You know, right. I want to do, you know, with it. So that's just kind of part of what the system has done. And so I'm not faulting, you know, anyone for that. I'm just, you know, acknowledging, I mean, that that's what it is.
It's not about fault. Again, we're acknowledging what it is, and we acknowledge that within this society, this American society that has a large Christian adhering body, that some of these, you know, principles and policies of the church have been used to oppress other people. It is American history. That's what it is. It is a very American practice. And what you will find is that our faith spaces thrive because they are safe spaces for us in our blackness. Even if our blackness is not centered. Sometimes your blackness is centered because your whole church is black. So it's not like you're constantly fighting for recognition because everybody in that joint is African-American or African-rooted. But there are some churches that are intentionally centering black cultural experience and worshiping from that perspective. Yeah. So when we talk about faith that has not affirmed blackness and wanting to talk about faith that does, it is kind of moving from an unhealthy and possibly unloving understanding of how you fit into the body of Christ to making space for yourself and being comfortable within the body of Christ because you are now affirming that you actually belong there.
I would definitely agree that it is unloving. Okay. And so let's try to fix that. So one of the ways that faith does not affirm blackness is when faith, through its eschatology or its theodicy, in terms of how it views justice, positions liberation as a reward for death.
Right. Meaning, so you're not free till you die.
Right. So you can struggle all your life, and God will make it all right at the end of this. Mm-hmm. Like God will eventually come after you die and you'll be renewed and restored and he'll, you know, make everything all right.
Right. While that may be true, there is justice available on this side of Zion. You can work toward a position of liberation. You can be free here.
Yeah.
I think that over-reliance on liberation as a reward for death is rooted in how Christianity was presented to unfree people, to people who were not free,
right,
who had no real chance of freedom in their lifetime. So almost like the dangling carrot of their participation in that system is, it will be made well when you die.
Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. I mean, slaves who were looking for freedom, mm-hmm, you know, like you will be free. And it's always
just
when
not
you die.
Here, when you die.
When you die.
So a lot of slave insurrections, you know, if we look at the Nat Turner example, Nat Turner, who said that he received a word from God that was going to lead the slave rebellion in Southampton County, Virginia. That was a snatching back of the liberation on this side of Zion. And while these things may be violent, the system of slavery was violent. His response to it was violent. But it was also a spiritual affirmation that he could be free as a man living in this time.
Mm-hmm.
He was a man fighting for freedom.
Right.
You know, however we tell that story, however that story is told, it is important to understand that he was an enslaved man who was being instructed to not ever expect to operate as a man, to not operate according to the levels of manhood that he saw being displayed by other men of other races all around him. The great equalizer was the violence that was exchanged between those two groups. So it's not an advocation of that, but you have to be careful about how these rebellions, these acts of resistance mm-hmm. are described, because even Denmark Vesey was a pastor, right? So it gets to a point where a person who's really grabbing a hold of the word, who somehow has become literate, which was illegal,
right,
got a hold enough of God's word to say, this ain't right,
mm-hmm.
and began to do what? Agitate for freedom on this side
mm-hmm.
of, you know, living, as opposed to saying, oh, that will be my reward for being, you know, obedient
yeah.
for the duration of my life.
So anything that says that, you know, don't necessarily worry about this right here, because mm-hmm. what's coming on the other side of this is better, does not affirm blackness, because that is a faith that ignores the reality and experience of oppression,
exactly.
which is a real thing for people. It's
in
not
general,
just black people,
not
it's
just black people,
right? It's
women,
immigrants,
with people of other faiths.
Mm-hmm.
These things are harmful, and anybody who asks you to toe that line, you know, not rock the boat and begin to deny people their access to happiness or to safety or to understanding or to love, and they're saying that is because, you know, that is not a reflection of my faith, you kind of have to think about that.
Yeah.
You have to kind of think critically about that. Like, what about love keeps you from showing love to others?
Right.
That doesn't even make sense. Yet on a corporate level, we do have people who are acting under the guise of, you know, what they say is Christianity, which is kind of a corporate capitalism Christianity, which is
yeah.
foolishness, who are doubling down on their bets that they are the only people who, you know, God loves and who God will look out for.
Right. Another way, if your faith ignores history and the systems that create different lived experiences and denies those differences, that is not a faith that affirms black people. And what I mean by that is, let's say there's this idea of this trope of the exceptional Negro.
Mm-hmm.
And that is usually somebody that's held up by typically white people and say, look at what they did. They did mm-hmm. this great thing. And, you know, they were able to accomplish
this. Why can't you be more like them?
Right. So if you think about like Martin Luther King, and we look at Martin Luther King as this great, you know, person. Martin Luther King was a great person, but things like the March on Washington would not have happened were they not allowed to happen. So Martin Luther King was basically the person that was chosen mm-hmm. by those in power. The reason why he was chosen is because he preached a message of nonviolence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at first, they didn't pay attention to Martin Luther King. They didn't want to have anything to do with him because he was advocating for rights for blacks.
Mm-hmm.
He said, no, we don't want those. So he pushed it, nonviolence. They beat him, nonviolence. Malcolm comes along with the Nation of Islam, and he says, listen, you're denying it. We're going to take
completely
it by any means necessary.
Shits. He was with it.
So people in power said, wait a minute.
We like Martin.
We don't want this by any means necessary. Tell us again what you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
Martin. And so Martin was the person who they allowed to ascend to, even though he did the work. I'm not taking
not
away
even
from.
Allowed. I just feel like they tolerated
they
him.
They tolerated
yeah.
him because it worked for them. He spoke the language that was safe and it worked for them.
Mm-hmm.
But anyone else, with Marcus Garvey, it didn't work for him. Malcolm X, it didn't work for him.
So I feel like Martin actually benefited. We say a lot of things start with language. Martin used the language of those that were in power running these oppressive systems. So when people in power running these oppressive systems want to talk to you about the graciousness of God, the long suffering of his people, and even you know, something that's being echoed in pop culture right now, you know, the need for civility, it's like, I feel like they literally surveyed the landscape and said, we don't want a two-front war, so let's just choose the front that we think will be most advantageous mm-hmm. to us, because he's speaking our language. I think still to this day, you have an othering of people who follow other religions outside of Christianity. There's 7 billion people on the earth.
Yeah.
You know, to think that all of them should be of one belief system is kind of asinine, but I mean, whatever people are doing. But I think that, you know, when you talk about Martin and you talk about Malcolm, in that particular time, I think that the powers that be were aware that it was a cauldron. Mm-hmm. It was, the pot was hot.
Yeah.
Right? So Malcolm is like, turn it up.
Right.
And Martin is like, lower it down. We can simmer. We can actually handle this.
And that is the pattern. So,
and they killed him anyway.
That was Martin and Malcolm's dichotomy. The same thing happened with W.E.B. Du Bois and Marcus Garvey.
Mm-hmm.
Those two philosophies, there's no movement that happens unless those two philosophies are present in terms of civil rights for black people, liberation for black people. People don't listen to the person that's saying, hey, we want more rights, or this is not fair,
mm-hmm.
until the other person is saying, oh, we coming for our rights.
Well, I think, again, people are surprised by, and it, you know, we're not going to do deep historical analysis.
We're talking about faith here,
but it is important to understand that we're not talking about people who were necessarily non-believers either. Mm-hmm. So there's a different debate between Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois about what does it mean to be a fully participating African-American who's free. How should you participate now in this society, mm-hmm. that doesn't see you as a slave? And one of the places where there was great tension was not just in what type of work you pursued, but also how do you demonstrate your satisfaction with your station?
Yeah.
How much do you rely on, at the time, the church as an anchor of community to demonstrate your satisfaction with your station? And what kind of added to W.E.B. Du Bois's radical stance, I give you the quote fingers, is that he demanded to be seen fully as a highly skilled man, regardless of his religious outward, mm-hmm. reflection. That could be very threatening to people who say, you are not that unless you're doing even your faith space exactly as I say to do it.
Right. So a faith that ignores the systems that were put in place to create these different lived experiences will look like in your church. Try to have a discussion about Colin Kaepernick in your church, and you'll see, mm-hmm. where your faith goes. Like, because a faith that is understanding of liberation, or liberating of people, or the fair, mm-hmm. and equal treatment of people,
yeah.
under the banner of Christ, mm-hmm. would say, of course you should stop killing people in the streets. That's not fine. That's not fair.
Right.
You should, of course people should
God not be, is not pleased with that.
Yeah. That should be an easy thing to say.
Right.
But what I'm saying is, a faith that does not affirm blackness does not acknowledge the systems that have put in place. So you'll be more likely to say, well, someone broke the law. Well, Alton Sterling should have been selling cigarettes. He didn't have a permit.
Like, these are misdemeanors. But I've always said, you know, the affirmation of blackness.
CDs, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Cigarettes, yeah.
The affirmation of blackness in these spaces has to do with the fact that you're actually affirming humanity, black humanity. Yeah. So it's not so much that somebody broke the law or somebody felt like, you know, they needed to defend themselves or their life was in danger. It's more so, what is the value of a life?
Mm-hmm.
What exactly rises to the level of, you know, execution on sight?
Yeah.
You know, and if we begin to rob ourselves of the ability to critically think about what it means to be human and what we expect for human life, you will find that train will get away from you, because you believe that everybody sees humanity the same way. So the danger in not affirming these different lived experiences is that you'll just continuously draw the conclusion that what we're saying is not true.
Mm.
And it's true.
Yeah.
Because it's our perspective. And even that perspective is not homogenous. But when you begin to look at, like, you know what, I wonder how police violence and brutality looks to people who constantly have their neighborhoods under surveillance. You know what I mean? If you look at that, and not from the standpoint of gentrification or anything else like that, but how would I feel if my kids couldn't even walk to school without a cop menacing them, threatening them, or saying crazy things to them? You might look at
or somebody shooting at them because they were trying to find the directions to school.
Something ridiculous. Something ridiculous. So we have these examples, and they may not be comfortable to deal with, but you really got to wrangle that thing, because in this particular country, so much of it is rooted in racism that it leads back to this uncomfortable conversation that we, you know, that we have to have. Black people starting out in white churches used to be about slaves being on the back two rows or along the sides of white churches listening to these messages, but not able to read the word. When they began to be able, even when they took the messages orally out of the building, they affirmed their blackness with them. Yeah. They began to compare themselves to what they heard. I don't think they knew. We just said, I wouldn't have been talking about Hebrews in Egypt being let out.
Right.
If I wanted my slaves to stay slaves in perpetuity.
Yeah. Yeah, they got free. And then hey, I'm looking at a whole group of people that wish they could get free, but I'm saying, you'll be free when you die.
Yeah, and they like, Moses wasn't even dead. That's literally what they're doing.
Yeah. Another way that happens is when that faith exclusively presents an unfamiliar God.
Right.
Now, here's the thing. I understand white Jesus, that white Jesus that's presented. Mm-hmm. I understand wanting to see yourself as God. You know, my issue with it is when that is the only thing that's presented like that, then you really are showing a limited God. And then you have to ask, why are you doing that? Because in Ethiopian art, in the Coptic church, their God looks like Ethiopians, like they're darker skinned God. Jewish God would look Jewish, you know. And then you're also, we'll talk about like, why is your God always male? Like things like when you're presenting an unfamiliar God to people, those people will inevitably ask, well, where am I? Like where this doesn't affirm who I am as a human being.
So God as Father, that idea kind of carries along the paternalism too, that you don't need to see yourself because ultimately he's your a parental figure. So when we talk about understanding white Jesus or why he continues to show up in so many non-white spaces, I think that is just the vestiges of how these spaces came into formation anyway. And people probably did not realize how harmful an image of a God that does not look like them might be to, you know, their development of a personal worship or personal faith understanding within their religion. So like, remember that episode of Good Times where Michael wanted to take
go ahead, because we gotta say what it is.
But he wanted to take the picture of white Jesus down, and Florida was like, don't touch my picture.
Michael Evans was the first woke person in all of television. That little boy was smart.
He was smart. But he was also, I think they also harnessed that energy of the 70s, which was a hard recentering of, you know, black is beautiful, and what does that look like in a household? And I think that was a really, even though it was dramatized for TV or for a sitcom, it was kind of an accurate exchange of a younger understanding, a more inclusive understanding. I demand to see me versus this is how it's always been. Yeah. This is how it's going to be. White Jesus been good to me all this time. Right. Because what were we hoping? We were hoping that white people would ultimately just be good. Mm-hmm. So if you carry that belief from your God figure to actual humans, aren't you walking around hoping that they're just going to be good?
Look at how that bar has lowered over the time. Because so you go from you wanting white people to set you free as slaves
to just leave
me alone. That's really where the bar is right now. Just leave us alone. We'll figure it out. Stop discriminating against us in your policy. Stop pulling us over for no reason. Stop. Just leave us alone. Alright, so are we talking about faith? We are, I promise.
We are.
Alright, so if if your church doesn't ever wrestle with how its faith has been complicit in the history of this country, then that is not a faith that affirms blackness. Because
and we're not safe there.
We're not. Christianity played a major part in advocating for slavery.
Huge. Some of the best records on slavery were kept by the church, meaning like in areas like Louisiana, because the Roman Catholic Church was so influential in that area because it used to be owned by France and by Spain. Free or slave, a birth was recorded and put into a church logbook. So Black folks coming from this particular area of the country have a lot of success in researching their genealogy because the church kept those types of records. Now, why did they keep those types of records? Because ultimately they wanted to know who was in the parish. Yeah. Ultimately they wanted to know, you know, how big had this family grown or who was a part of it. That used to be a part of the church's function. Before you had a Bureau of Vital Records, all you had was baptism records from your church if you were able to get baptized.
These are things that we as Black people have to wrestle with. We have to say, we have to answer questions when we go into our communities and say, why you believe in that white Jesus, or why you believe in this white, you know, Christianity, mm-hmm. or whatever, why you believe in this Christianity that was given to you in slavery. Black people should not be the only people wrestling with those questions.
Exactly.
Because we didn't do it. Like, we're choosing, we're trying to make the best of the situation.
True.
But this is not something that we cause. And if your church is not wrestling with those questions, that is not an affirming church.
Yeah. We have to talk about faith that affirms Blackness, because we continue to see groupthink at play, even in our secular institutions, that says that when Blackness is not affirmed in a positive way in our faith spaces, it shows up in our policies. We have yet to be disproven. So we cannot possibly see ourselves the same way before the same God if your vote continuously minimizes or mitigates my ability to move about freely in this country. We not doing the same thing. We don't want the same thing. We hardly agree on anything beyond we say, I'm a Christian. And that is too divergent.
But even then, I'm like, are you?
Well, yeah, I think to the person who experiences the brunt of the impact, the person with the least amount of power is going to experience the impact of the more powered position's actions. So we see that. So like, if you are constantly affirming your position by your actions, and your actions do not affirm the humanity of others, it will show up, because you're a part of the majority group. It's going to show up in places that have nothing to do with church. The border has nothing to do with church, yet evangelicals, white evangelicals to be specific, are responsible as a voting bloc. That means that there is some sort of belief that is permeating that group that calls it followers of Christ that says, we need a wall. We need these policies. We need these certain things, you know, and we always stand on the side of, you know, law enforcement. They're never wrong or whatever. Like, it's getting to the point where it's just noise.
Yeah, it's going to show up in your stance on gun rights. Now, we had a show on Bibles and guns, and one of the things that's always been confusing from where I sit is I see same people in church, same people, you know, same evangelicals supporting the NRA, you know, supporting gun rights. And the rationale is, they may say, I don't think that we, you know, should have these weapons or these weapons, but I have my weapons for self-defense if something were to happen. And so I'm wondering, well we don't get to claim self-defense in any capacity. We can't defend ourselves, even to the point of vocalizing through a silent protest. So how is it that, you know, you can reconcile your, in self-defense of yourself, you will shoot people, but you give a different measure to other people who want to defend themselves?
I just think that so that's one of those glaring double standards. But when you beat back the difference between your identification as a Christian, period, versus the things that people, it's so easy for a person to say, I don't see color, when color does not affect them. It's so easy for a person to say, I treat rich and poor the same, when they are, you know, rich, so they don't really know how it is to live as a poor person, or they've never been challenged on that, because you don't know rich people. You see what I'm saying? Like, it's very easy to say what you would do ideally, and I don't like the flowery language. I said many shows ago that you will be explaining how race and class and gender affect people. And if you call somebody a racist, they will stop the conversation for their emotions about being called a racist. And they will never examine the behavior or the words that led you, a person, to state that to the positive. Like, oh, I mean, you know, to the affirmative, rather. Oh, you're a racist. You see what I'm saying? They, oh my God, how could you call me that? Blah, blah. I think the same thing happens when we're talking about people who are both non-black and Christian, and the things that they might do as a group that affect other people who are black or other marginalized groups and also identify as Christian. And how does your energy affect everybody else? So we're talking about affirmation of blackness, but we're talking about affirmation of everything that is not at the top of this societal structure. That's really what we're talking about.
Yeah. So how does that affect, like, the people who are victims of that? Like, how does that affect us? Like, when you don't get to see a God that looks like you,
you make him look like you, and it makes people uncomfortable. We shout out Black Jesus all the time.
All the time.
All the time. Because there's certain things that Black Jesus does for me. Like when I have a less stressful interaction with the police. Mm. I don't think white Jesus did that. Mm. I think Black Jesus with the dreads did that.
Yeah, you gotta be able to have the liberty to understand God as you
yeah. are. Or like,
to see yourself in God.
I get an extra bump and some money that I didn't expect, right, or whatever. I definitely feel like the God who looks like me and understands my lifestyle, mm-hmm, looks out for me.
Yeah, but so when churches vote as a block, or Christians vote as a block, or when you go into these faith spaces, because we do go, and mm-hmm, we go into these multicultural spaces, mm-hmm, and see, you know, like, what's going on here? Like, why? When we see that creates this unbridgeable chasm between us. And it's not anything that, you know, it's something that we wish was not there, mm-hmm, and you almost feel powerless to impact it. Because, one, why is all the work on me to change, mm-hmm, this? Why don't you see this? Why
that's
don't
a
you
supremacist see this structure?
And then two, you know, you're not gonna do it, like you, yeah, because you haven't done it. When you know, so you want to experience some type of community with other people that are in Christ, mm-hmm, but you know, it's rare that you would see them come to a predominantly black space and worship consistently and, you know, be subject to black leadership and, mm-hmm, things like that. Mm-hmm. It's more often than not, it goes the other way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just, it's a tough thing. It's like, yo, y'all don't care about us. That's really what it is.
So I think this happened. What just came to my mind was Aretha Franklin's funeral, mm-hmm, her eulogy. Like, that whole service leading up to that eulogy was an affirmation of various facets of blackness, whether it be the creativity, the idea that Queen Mother had changed her clothes four times. People were losing their stuff over, mm-hmm, the fact that she was diva, you know, through the final presentation of the body. And we got a glimpse of Black Detroit funeral, mm-hmm, culture and church culture. And it was a parade of Black excellence in the arts and in music as far as coming together to honor her.
Yeah.
And in 20 minutes, this person undid, mm-hmm, so much of that. And the things that were coming out of his mouth and from his perspective that nobody asked him to stay, to say, not only undercut various facets of this differentiated lived experience that some black people, black and female people have, but it undercut the person that people have been called together to honor.
Right.
And I think that even being offended about the latter.
We're talking about the eulogy.
Yeah, the eulogy, the actual eulogy where he, you know, discussed black on black crime and people need to get married and stop having babies out of wedlock and all this. And it's just like, you're doing so much that nobody asked you to do, but you're trying to come for everybody. You actually came for the honoree. Mm-hmm. And the disgust that people had around that just had to do with we had created a space.
Mm-hmm. Did a great job. It was over 8 hours. Excellence.
It was a full day of excellence. And I mean, you don't want to think of a funeral as entertaining, but between this and Whitney's funeral, like, yeah, like, oh, yeah. these were our days. These were, you know, black holidays. And he managed to undercut all of that in 20 minutes because he did not affirm those various facets because it didn't fall in line with his worldview, actually. It was damaging. And again, we talk about news cycle and we move on and we don't even think about it. But just in this moment, that is a timely example of what can happen. People were upset for a week after that, if not more. All the thought pieces that came out. Damn. Oh, he's trash. You know what I'm saying? It came out because you had one job.
Everything about that was great. Farrakhan was there. He was happy. He couldn't be happier. It was a beautiful experience of just blackness until it was that lack of affirmation just tanked it. Mm-hmm. So does the faith that we have, does Christianity actually affirm blackness, is one of the chief questions that we are forced to wrestle with. Mm-hmm. So we actually started this conversation at my church, and we carried this over into another conversation in another group that we have. Shout out to Unfit Christian Congregation. We actually did some work there in Breakoff Group, The Emergent. It was good. So in Acts chapter, I believe it's 10, mm-hmm. We get a story of what's believed and often titled as the first Gentile convert, Cornelius.
Okay.
And it's a rich man who, you know, educated or whatever, is converted to Christianity. And this is a big thing. You know, if you look him up, it's the first Gentile convert. Whatever. Mm-hmm. In chapter 8, before that, Philip, the apostle Philip, meets an Ethiopian eunuch. And the Ethiopian eunuch is reading from the book of Isaiah. And Philip comes up to him and he says, you know, do you know what you're reading? And the guy says, no, you know, I don't understand this part. Can you explain it to me? He explains about, you know, what's going on in Isaiah, what that means regarding Jesus, mm-hmm. why this is important. He shares Christ with this guy. This guy's like, yes, I'm with it. How do I get baptized? They find a spot to baptize him. That's the end of the interaction. That's the first convert.
Mm.
So the question becomes, why is he not held up as the first Gentile convert? He's mm-hmm. not a Jew. He's from Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm.
That's how this system works. Like, it just, there's no reasonable reason why Cornelius is the convert, except for the fact that, you know, he's a wealthy man, he has influence, he's the head of a house, which means there's servants and things like that. That does not disqualify
that this person was actually the first
convert. This African
mm-hmm.
was the first convert.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sit back and I wonder, well, how does the narrative change when the first Gentile convert in all of Christianity is from Africa?
Mm-hmm.
Why is that not the story that we tell? But it's because the story is right there in the Bible.
Right.
So, like, those type of things are important. The when we talked last week, we mentioned Hagar and what happened when she left the enslavement of Abraham and Sarah, and she went back home. Hagar is the only person in the Bible to give God a name.
Mm-hmm.
And
the God name, who sees me.
The God who sees me.
Yep.
Hagar is an African woman. She's from Egypt. Hagar is familiar with the Egyptian god, Amun-Ra.
Mm-hmm.
Amun-Ra is the god who sees.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you always see this eye as the symbol. When she had the opportunity to name God, she did not name the god of her oppressor, the people who slaved her and forced her to have a child. She did not name Yahweh. She named that god after the god who sees, mm-hmm. after her culture,
mm-hmm.
her African culture. That is not something that we draw out of scripture. That's not something that we're going to preach, but that is an affirmation that...
A powerful affirmation.
Your culture matters to you.
Yeah.
Like, you get this honor of naming me, and I understand why you're naming me, because I'm the God that you know. I'm the God who sees. And these type of things are things that Christianity can do, and I believe that we must do, because they're important. Mm-hmm. Africans are important to this story.
Majorly. And I mean, it's not, you don't even want to say it anticlimactically, like, duh. But I think that so much energy has gone into misstating certain aspects of the Bible. You know, when the Bible does not affirm supremacist culture, it's called the myth part, or the, you know, these are the parts that are not real, because these are the parts that cannot be easily co-opted by, for lack of a better term, the powers that be, whoever those powers are. So I always talk about, you know, the mystery of God, and I believe him to be a lover of those who have the least amongst us. Whether you having the least amongst us is your natural condition or is something that is a created condition around you. And I think it is telling to, again, going back to that example of people who were not free sitting in a church in a forced situation, listening to how God freed a whole enslaved population. This is the only thing, you know, I feel like sometimes people are very, very flippant about, you know, what is the value of Christianity now? Or, you know, again, why do you follow that white Jesus? And why do you still worship the God of your oppressors? And I'm just like, are y'all historians? Like, do y'all read for real? Because I feel like there is no way to avoid that Christian mythology is not parallel, but it is deeply rooted in African societies that you would be willfully ignoring, that obviously something about the rooting of the history that produced this religion looks like us. Mm. It looks like us. And when you understand that it looks like us, then you start to say, is that why no one has ever expressly said that? It may not celebrate certain things. It may not, you know, may not call certain functions and processes the same thing, but it's like realizing that Solomon was not, you know, pale-faced. Mm. It's impossible. Right?
You would have to ask yourself those questions.
I mean, you would have to look at a map and see who these people look like right now. Mm-hmm. And like this, for instance, you know, when people who come over here from the Middle East and Egypt, when they come over here, they're allowed to check white on census boxes. Mm-hmm. And some people do that willfully. They don't even correlate that idea with it. But even the idea of trying to somehow retake Egyptian mythology as something European comes down to something so mundane as how you identify yourself. Y'all not white, but that's just my perspective. Egypt is a part of Africa. The idea that we built a canal that makes you think that Saudi Arabia, what is now Saudi Arabia, what is now the Middle East, was not just a landmass that was connected to Africa. So if you say that these religions, these three major religions, came out of this same area.
Well, people went back and forth all the time.
It's just like now. People went back and forth all the time. We are still discovering migratory patterns across Africa. Now, this is not, you know, an episode about Africanizing Christianity. This is about validating the fact that some of these roots are indeed African.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we get, and this is just for, you know, people who always get like, you know, slave masters gave us this religion and
slave masters gave us.
Yeah, first of all, just that's not how information spreads. That's not information in the Asian world does not spread by just skipping a whole continent in an ocean and then coming over here just to be given to slaves. There's Africans in the Bible. Yeah. There's not.
You would have to understand like medieval African and European history to understand why certain things unfolded by the 15th century.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where I understand the sentiment that they're frustrated because the faith was used mm-hmm. to to keep us enslaved.
Yes.
And that's something that we all have to deal with, black people, white people, especially white people.
Especially white people.
But we all have to deal with it. Then we still can have these intellectual conversations about what is actually there in the material. And in the material, you'll claim that American slaves were the first people exposed to Christianity, the first blacks exposed to Christianity, is nonsensical.
That's it's not even true.
It's ahistorical. It doesn't make any sense. So what it is we are conditioned, all of us, black, white, any race in America, are constantly bombarded with anti-blackness.
Mm-hmm.
It is something that is difficult to escape, but it's something that we must escape. And for black people, it's something that we have to be vigilant about, how we internalize these messages and fight against these messages. It's in our faith, it's in every aspect of our lives. I mean, you cannot adopt some of these tropes that, let's say, black people are lazy.
It's a lie.
You work just as hard, at least as hard as everyone else.
Yeah.
You do. And, you know, it's... and so we do. You hear this, like, you know, I'm not going to any black stores or this bad customer service. Stop. You gotta. You're getting that.
It's damaging, actually.
You're getting that from somewhere that's not you. Like, that's not... It's not true, first of all. Mm-hmm. Everyone has bad customer service. It's not just black people. You just happen to live in a black area, so a lot of the people that work there are black. But you go to a different area, you won't find some bad customer service also.
Exactly.
It's not...
You're going to find humans anywhere.
Everywhere.
Some of this is about affirming that black people are human first, because so many different stereotypes have filled in that space before affirmation of just that humanity.
Yeah. And as a church, if we're going to spend time denouncing trivial things like, you know, we shouldn't be smoking, you know, we shouldn't. Like, who cares? Like, we shouldn't be drinking. We need to avoid the appearance of evil. If we need to avoid the appearance of evil, then we need to avoid also actual evil. The actual evil of racism.
Exactly.
Of which the church has participated
in. Don't pick and choose. Exactly.
Like, I don't care if it looks like I'm evil. I care about the actual evil that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So this anti-blackness that we all are guilty of, mm-hmm. is one of those things that we just got it, because you need to be able to affirm yourself, but you mm-hmm. cannot do that if you're doing this other thing.
Yeah.
If you're buying into this trope of...
And there are going to be good people and, you know, bad people, but blackness is not inherently bad. And that is what we're trying to come out from under. It's not inherently bad. The language sneaks in.
Yeah.
Like you say, you talk about laziness, you talk about sexuality.
Hypersexuality. No, yeah. Everyone's sexual.
Everybody.
That's not it's not a hyper or anything.
Anything. And if you realize where those stereotypes were rooted and why that language took root and what it allowed to happen, you wouldn't use it. One of the things I hate to hear is calling a girl fast. I hate it.
Yeah.
And... oh, I hate it. But I hate it because it puts all of the onus on a child, you know, to own the fullness of a sexuality that she probably doesn't understand yet.
Mm-hmm.
And you can call a girl fast, but you hardly ever ask who the hell is chasing her.
Yeah. That is so. Dr. Tamara Lomax has a book called Jezebel Unhinged.
Mm-hmm.
And in the book,
mm-hmm.
she does an excellent job of many things, but one of the things is identifying the different struggle that black women had to endure during slavery. So we all know slavery was hard. We all know black people had to work. Black women also had the additional burden of fulfilling all men's fantasies, the slave masters and the husbands and the men that were there. They also had the burden of bearing children that they did not want.
Yep.
And caring for children
on
that were
purpose.
Not theirs. It is difficult.
It's a lot. We could probably spend a whole episode on that.
And then for those reasons that they did not choose, they were hypersexualized.
Yep.
And you would think that, you know, it's
after
it's
enduring
the men.
all of that either overuse or violence, straight up violence, it somehow fell to her to somehow make herself more modest, to not attract those violent tendencies. That is the biggest crock of shit that continues to, I think, just demonize black women, you know? So we, and sometimes, like, don't believe the hype. Sometimes people who have the most to say about, you know, how a young girl dresses or how she carries herself, they wish they were that free. This is why we always talking about, you know, celebrating some of the imagery and some of the victory of a Cardi B, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because at such a young age, she's like, I don't even care. Mm-hmm. And there is freedom in her not caring what you think, because there's just an understanding. I'm just a woman.
It's just
she hasn't done anything fun, you know what I mean?
It's not different.
It's not superhuman. She's just a woman.
It's like black people who don't eat watermelon because they don't want to be seen as the black person eating watermelon.
What?
Meanwhile, everybody's out here eating watermelon.
One day,
everybody can enjoy their watermelon but us.
Fried chicken and watermelon in the same day. And when I tell you, like, it's probably happened many times, but when I noticed it, I always chuckle to myself. Because I'm like, ooh, I'm having a highly stereotypical black moment. But I enjoy it.
And it's not black. Popeyes is not in business because of black dollars. Popeyes is in business because chicken is delicious.
Yes.
And everyone loves it. So
yes.
We got to stop doing it. Like
We have to stop doing it. You have to be aware of the stereotypes and the language that has been used. And unfortunately, used within our face spaces. Because, like, as you can see, this conversation is like a wet fish. Like, it could just jump and go any and everywhere. But we're talking about how the continuation of a misuse of language and the continuation of a mischaracterization of blackness actually harms people within their faith spaces. Like, just to get back to that.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you gotta constantly affirm, one, yourself.
Yeah.
Because since we're talking about faith, Jesus said in Matthew, when the disciples in Matthew 22, when the disciples asked him, what is the greatest commandment? He said, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your mind, mm-hmm. and with all your strength. This is a quote from Deuteronomy 6:5 that he's quoting. Then he says, and the second command is like it, love your neighbor as you love yourself. And so a lot of times that's boiled down to love God, love people. But what's missed is as you love yourself.
Yeah.
That has to happen first before you love people. And you got to take time to actually affirm yourself when you're in a world that does everything possible to not do that. When you're in your faith spaces and then you leave there and then you have to drive home and you're worried about having to be the perfect driver just so you can get home.
Right.
Then you have to go to work and you have to be a different person all the time. And then you have to get around other people who are also black people like you, but also have internalized these messages of anti-blackness. And you have to constantly fight to affirm yourself. You have to ask yourself, does your faith cause you to love yourself? Because mm-hmm. it should. There are beautiful things here. God is telling us in all throughout the scriptures to love yourself. Jesus met with Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus was not black. Zacchaeus was a tax collector who was basically vile to the community he was in because he was robbing them mm-hmm. to give money to the Romans. And so he was a traitor to them. And so Jesus went to him and said, and first of all, that just makes Jesus unapproachable at that point, because why would you do that? I mean, you Jesus, why? And then he not only goes to him and talks to him in front of all these people, he goes to his house and has a meal with him, which is a very intimate thing. God is, and through Jesus, through Yahweh, through all of these messages, through the people in the Bible, saying, listen, it doesn't matter what they say about you. What I say about you is what matters. What you say about yourself is what matters. And so we have to continually fight the fight to affirm ourselves
mm-hmm.
through how we see God, through our theology, through everything that we are, because you're going to be black all the time.
All the time.
And it's a beautiful thing.
Yes.
It's as much trouble as it is, not that we cause it, it's I wouldn't be anything else.
For real.
I wouldn't be anything else. Oh, my God. Because we out here doing it.
It's just beautiful.
We out here surviving despite all these odds.
And when I feel like there is community in that place, in that space, where we're constantly, those of us who are capable of doing it, we are constantly showing each other that love and that acknowledgement. Like, I see you. Because I feel like so many of systems and spaces and things are not meant for us, but we're there and we're trying to thrive, if not fully thriving, regardless.
So keep doing the work, y'all.
Thanks, y'all.
For Faith Uncut, I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.